What I would talk about tonight, or what I'm planning on talking about, is what's known in Buddhism as the Four Noble Truths. And I haven't talked, I was trying to remember when the last time I talked about it. And it seems that it was maybe 4 years ago, something like that, long ago. And it seemed appropriate maybe for today, since this is supposed to be the beginning, first day of an introductory series. So it's pretty basic Buddhism. The most central teaching of Buddhism. I'm usually a little bit reluctant to give extremely Buddhist teachings when I do the introductory course, partly because I feel that the meditation practice is so valuable in and of itself that I don't want to taint it with religion or with Buddhism. Maybe that's not fair to say that way exactly, but or to frighten people away if they hear too much about Buddhism. Because the mindfulness practice exists very nicely independent of Buddhism. The beginning of Buddhism is sometimes considered to be the Buddha's first sermon. After he was enlightened, he went for a long walk and found some old friends of his and taught them the Dharma, his teaching. And Buddhism is supposed to have begun, not so much when he had his experience of awakening, but when he actually started teaching. And the sutra, the scripture which describes this first sermon, is called the Sutra of Turning the Wheel of the Dharma. And this first sutra was the Buddha's first attempt to try to describe what he had learned in becoming awake, in becoming totally present. And it said that at first the Buddha was reluctant to teach at all. And he felt that it was too difficult to teach and that what he had discovered was too difficult to explain and no one would understand. And then, as the legend goes, he was prompted by one of the gods to please reconsider. And then he surveyed the people of the world and realized that there were many people who had little dust in front of their eyes. Who would understand. And so then, out of an act of compassion, out of compassion for the suffering of the world, he then began to teach. So this first sutra is his attempt to formulate perhaps what is unformulatable, can't be formulated. And I wonder, can we really describe accurately the boundless sense of presence? And all of us, I think, have some sense of what it's like to be present, or of presence itself. And there's a kind of boundlessness, boundless sense in which that feeling is. And can that really be described? Anyway, this first sermon was an attempt not so much to describe the boundless sense of awakening itself, maybe because it can't be described, but rather the teachings, the practice, that was supposed to help us understand or lead us to freedom itself. So the heart of the Buddha's first sermon and the heart of Buddhist teaching in general ever since has been this formulation known as the Four Noble Truths. And in talking about the Four Noble Truths, the Buddha took an ancient medical formula, an ancient Indian medical formula, and applied it to his understanding of the human condition. And the medical formula, which predates Buddhism, was an Indian doctor, an ancient doctor, would look and see. First you'd notice what the illness was. So that's the first step, is to what is the illness. The second step is, what is the cause of the illness? And the third step was to discern what the prognosis might be, what the possible result of a cure might be. And the fourth step is to prescribe the cure. And so this fourfold kind of formula from Indian medicine, it was adopted by the Buddha to describe the human condition and the path to awakening, in a sense. So very simply put then, the way he reworded it for himself was there is suffering, that's the illness. There is a cause of suffering. There is the possibility of the end of suffering, and there is a path, that's the cure, the path to end suffering. And And I think it's significant that the Buddha chose to use a medical formulation and not some philosophical or metaphysical formulation model for his teaching. And in fact, the Buddha was strictly, very strictly anti-metaphysical in his teaching. He preferred to remain pragmatic, pragmatically within the empirical world of our lives and the dynamics of our lives. The Buddha over and over again rejected metaphysics, was not interested in it, but really wanted to focus on what some people have called just simply therapy, good therapy. There's suffering, and he was concerned about alleviating that suffering whenever, wherever he saw it. And also, the idea of a medical model is kind of nice, because with a medical model, once you've taken the cure, and the cure has succeeded, you dispense with the medicine. Isn't that nice? So maybe that's what we're supposed to do with Buddhism. It's often said that Buddhism is supposed to be self... Well, not self-destroying, but self... What?
Obsolescence.
Yeah, self-help, what is it?
Obsolescence.
Yeah, planned obsolescence. Planned obsolescence built into it. And these Four Noble Truths are tools which are used to help us understand our lives. And they're not supposed to be taken as dogma to be believed. And it sounds really kind of weighty, heavy, to call them the Four Noble Truths. You know, four is okay, but noble, that's kind of a little bit charged. And then you hear the truths, you know, it's a capital T, and suddenly you're in philosophy department. And, well, the word noble is maybe... people have seemed to have pretty much settled on this being the best English translation. Some people have used the word holy. The word, which was rather unfortunate because of historical events, is Arya, which means Aryan. And so we don't. I think most of us don't want to say the four Aryan truths. But noble seems to work. So they're really tools, and so how do we use them as tools is the question of how to use the Four Noble Truths. And it's indeed it's suggested that each of us find our own formulation, our own concepts and words to fill into this medical model. We take this medical model and find what concepts work for us in our deepest understanding of ourselves. So there is this wonderful Mahayana sutra called the Flower Ornament Scripture. And this is a rather big book, and this is only a third of the book. And it's quite fantastic. And if you read this, you should read it out loud, and let yourself be pulled into the imagery, and you'll have an altered state of consciousness. And there's a whole chapter on the Four Holy Truths. And what this chapter does, he calls it holy. What he does is, what the chapter describes is many different worlds, because there are many different worlds out there, according to Buddhist cosmology. And what's common to all those worlds is the Four Noble Truths. That's always common. It's always common. Wherever Buddhas teach, there's the Four Noble Truths. But the way they formulate it, the kind of the concepts they use, vary. So our Buddha, in our world system, he used the word suffering, the cause of suffering, end of suffering, and the path leading to end of suffering. So it describes all these different worlds in the different ways it was formulated. And then, just for example, there's a world called endurance. There's all these wonderful names to the worlds. One of them is called endurance. And the holy truth of suffering in this world, endurance is sometimes called wrongdoing, or oppression, or change, or clinging to objects, or thorn stabbing, or deceit, or the place of cancer, or ignorant action. The holy truth of the end of suffering in this world endurance may be called non-contention, or freedom from defilement, or tranquility, or death, or the deathlessness, or absence of inherent nature, so on and on. In this world, there are 4 quadrillion such names to express the 4 holy truths in accord with the mentalities of sentient beings, to cause them all to be harmonized and pacified. 4 quadrillion ways of saying the 4 noble truths. Isn't that impressive? I think what this means to me is that there's a different way of formulating for each one of us. And the interesting thing to do, it might change from day to day. And in taking on the 4 noble truths as a tool, as a teaching tool, the task for each of us is to find some personal way of saying it, what works for us. For some people, the word suffering doesn't seem to work, so doesn't really grab us. And for some people, it's a fine word. And since this is the kind of first night of the introductory course, a slogan which I want to kind of be known for is, in the world of direct perception, we are the only possible authority. And what we're trying to do in mindfulness practice is to directly perceive what is our own experience. Because in that world of direct perception, we are the only source of authority. No one else can be an authority. So how will you reformulate in your own words, according to your own experience, the famous 4 noble truths? It's understood that the 4 noble truths are 4 aspects of direct experience, direct insight. And the four noble truths presuppose the possibility of peace and contentment, of freedom. So the first noble truth is called the truth of suffering. And it's simply, the truth is simply a statement that there is such a thing as suffering in the world. And that's a pretty safe thing to say, an uncontroversial thing to say. What it doesn't mean, which is sometimes taken to mean by some people, is that everything is suffering, or that life is suffering. It's not what this first noble truth says. It's not a kind of pessimistic statement that all of life is suffering. It just simply states there is such a thing as suffering in the world. And it's not a denial of joy either. The Buddha said once, I teach one thing and one thing only, suffering and the end of suffering. There are perhaps other kind of religious goals and paths that a person can take. But in Buddhism, the focus of Buddhism is on suffering itself. Not because we like to dwell in suffering, but because suffering is unpleasant and we want to become free of it. And you can only become free of suffering if you understand it really well. Some religious traditions here in the West focus on sin as being the primary fundamental human problem. For Buddhists, it is suffering. It's kind of the primary fundamental condition which Buddhism is addressing. And I kind of like this focus on suffering as opposed to sin, because in some formulations, in Western formulations of sin, sin is kind of a permanent stain. And sometimes it's a stain that was acquired by the human race long time in the past. It's something that Adam and Eve did. And it's with us, and it's kind of very little we can do about it for ourselves. The focus on suffering in Buddhism is about suffering that's happening here and now, and what can be done now about alleviating. The causes of suffering are happening now. The causes of suffering didn't happen. The roots of it might have happened in the past. There's certainly continuity from the past into the present. But the suffering that we experience today, it only exists, according to Buddhism at least, because of the way in which we relate to the world now. So if we experience suffering now, there is a cause of suffering that's also happening now. The cause of that suffering is not happening in the past, even though there might be roots in the past. Um, So the first, there is a strong focus on suffering. And I think many of us have already recognized that we have a culture which tends to avoid suffering. It goes to tremendous extremes, to lengths, to try to avoid suffering. One of my best friends in the city told me, he went to a funeral today of his wife's grandmother. And so they viewed the open casket. And my friend is 39 years old. And he said, came back and said, that's the first time I ever saw a dead person. 39 years old. Kind of remarkable. And it isn't so much that Buddhism focuses on suffering exclusively, but rather Buddhist practice is about opening to the world as it is, to see it as it is, to encounter it as it is. And we can't see it or encounter it as it is if we're avoiding parts of it, if we're turning away from parts of it. The degree in which we turn away, to that degree we tend to augment or increase the suffering and the pain. So the first noble truth is kind of as a noble truth. It's perhaps an encouragement or an insistence that we become aware of our suffering, aware of our life as it is in an unbiased way. To stop brushing aside our problems, repressing our pains, our fears, or distracting ourselves from anxiety and dissatisfaction. It's also taught in the Buddhist tradition that to stay in touch with suffering, to have the ability, the capacity to stay in touch with suffering, nourishes our capacities of compassion. That to stay in touch with suffering in the world, it makes us sane. That it's difficult to be sane without being sensitive to the degree of suffering that exists in our world. So, part of Buddhist practice is not only developing the capacity to open up in an undistracted manner to our own suffering, but also to open up in an undistracted way to the suffering in the world around us. And it's said that this is a gift that we give the world, the capacity to witness, to be present for it, for that suffering. The word that's often translated, the word as suffering, the Sanskrit or Buddhist word, is dukkha. And dukkha means, literally, or kind of the etymological roots of the word, mean a wheel axle out of center, or out of kilter. And so when things are kind of off-center, that is dukkha. And we translate that as suffering. Sometimes it's translated as unsatisfactoriness, if things are unsatisfactory. I like very much John Kabat-Zinn's recent discussion somewhere. He prefers to use the word stress, partly because what he runs is a pain stress management clinic. But he likes it because suffering is kind of a loaded word. People say, oh, no, the Buddhists are here. Or whatever. But anyway, it's a loaded word. But stress... stress is an interesting word because things which are very, very pleasant and enjoyable or wonderful or ecstatic can also be stressful. And unless we... So, for example, I said there's like, I don't know, three or four major stressful events in a person's life. Apparently, what? I don't know, there's two major ones. There's maybe more minor ones. I don't know what they are. But there's something like, dying is pretty stressful. Or public speaking is pretty stressful. And losing one's livelihood is stressful. Losing one's loved one is stressful. One of the major sources of stress in these major categories is getting married. So I don't know how it is for you guys, but it's true for many people. And marriage is kind of a very joyful event, but it also has a certain amount of stress in it. So John Kabat-Zinn likes the word stress, because it doesn't have a certain kind of value connotations. It just, life seems to have stress in it, even great things. If I laugh too hard, if I go on and off like a couple of hours laughing hilariously, I tend to end up with a sore throat. So I just want to go through the three categories of suffering that the Buddhist tradition gives. Three kinds of suffering. The first type is called unavoidable suffering. And this is kind of, can be both physical and mental. And these are kind of things that just come along with being a human being. They can't be avoided. And traditionally it said, getting sick, getting old, and dying are kind of unavoidable suffering for the most part. We get sick, we injure ourselves, and we feel pain, and that pain is unavoidable, it's just part of life. And it's nice to know that the Buddha, for some of us it's nice to know, that the Buddha had a bad back. What is a Buddha doing with a bad back? But that's actually, if you read the stories of the Buddha's life, there were sometimes that he couldn't fulfill his teaching obligations. Said, excuse me, I have to go lay down, and asked one of his senior students, disciples, to teach in his stead. So it happens even to Buddhas. And also there's mental suffering, and there's grief and there's loss that happens, and even the Buddha, it said, had kind of mental suffering. It said he was anguished when his home kingdom, his home country, was conquered and destroyed. And whether you agree, so I don't know if you agree with that there's unavoidable suffering, but I think most people would. And so then, what is our relationship to that kind of suffering? Are we able to be present for it? Are we able to not turn away from it? Are we able not to feel pity or upset or anger when these things happen? And this kind of unavoidable suffering becomes particularly troublesome, a problem. When awareness contracts around it, or the body contracts around it, and we try to push it away or avoid it or reject it. Or it can be a problem if we try to avoid it through creating an identity of ourselves, a self, kind of self-image or identity, which is based on avoidance, which is true for many people. And there's a lot of pain in holding up that identity. Jung is supposed to have said, neurosis is always a substitute for legitimate suffering. So that's the first kind, is unavoidable suffering. Or dukkha. And I don't know what the best translation is for dukkha. The second kind of dukkha is what's called the suffering of impermanence, of change. And Buddhism puts a tremendous amount of stress on the impermanent, changing nature of reality, of life. It's probably one of the hallmarks of Buddhist teachings, is a stress in permanence. And things are changing usually much quicker than most people realize in normal states of awareness. But what Buddhists are particularly concerned about is not so much that mountains wear down and things change, but rather the changing nature of our experience of life. The way we experience our life is constantly changing. Our mental states, our moods, our emotions, our thoughts, our feelings are constantly changing. Changing, it says, the Buddhist calculations is that there are something like a billion thought moments in a minute, or something like that. So a million changes in a minute. Or what is it? You probably know better, Steve, than I do, the number. Do you know the number from Abhidharma? And the way many of us live our life in this world stream of change is like we take a Polaroid picture of it, and then we go around holding a Polaroid picture. You know, and things are continuing to change, and we're holding on to the picture. And one way to do that is to prefer one kind of emotion or mental state over another. And as soon as you have some kind of preference, try to hold on to it, then you are asking for big time trouble. And one of the things we're learning in meditation practice and mindfulness practice to find some kind of ease, some kind of peace in the midst of flux and change, in the midst of change, even when things change for the worse. Maybe when so that's a second form of suffering. The third form of suffering is called the suffering of all constructions. And constructions is a little bit odd word to use, maybe samskaras. And it means all the kind of ways in which our mind constructs a reality for ourselves. A lot of what we see around us as reality is in part a projection of our mental ideas and concepts and constructs. And we live a life very much in a world, in an ocean of mental constructs, of intellectual and abstract constructs. The superstructure for our life, the conceptual overlays, the self-image we have of ourselves, or the image we have of others, which might have nothing to do with reality. And many of these kind of superstructures that we overlay onto reality are ways of avoiding reality. So I was thinking, for example, if you kind of say, you know, my boss hates me. Well, maybe your boss does, or maybe that's simply a way of story to kind of project onto your boss, kind of the underlying, kind of a way of avoiding what's really going on, the pain or the particular issue. All these kind of elaborations we have about evaluations, judgments we have, all belong to this world of constructions. One of my first insights when I went to live in a Buddhist monastery after practicing sometimes was some kind of insight into the degree to which we paint, cover reality with our concepts. And it kind of, this is this maybe a silly example. In the Tassajara, this monastery I was staying at, they have these natural hot springs. And this is not a good example, I guess. But sometimes in the day, the hot spring pool was used for a bath. People take their baths. Sometimes it was a yogurt incubator. And when I was working in the kitchen, I was mostly concerned about those pools being good incubators. And I related to them that way. And when I wasn't in the kitchen, and because the kitchen was a nice and warm place, I wasn't worried about heat. But when I wasn't in the kitchen, I was out in the cold, then I was mostly concerned and saw it from the point of view of my body temperature and what was nice for me. And it was different temperatures depending on which, what you wanted. I don't know if that's a good example, but... Oh, here's a better example. Maybe. It's a hypothetical example of a Caltrans train conductor. I can imagine that someone who drives the train up and down the peninsula for 40 years, it can be, you know, one more time on the train. You know, it's like, oh my God, this is oppressive and I can't stand it, and all these, whatever, you know, it's just really, it's just oppressive to go on the train one more time, to be sitting there driving back and forth. And the conductor has maybe a 5-year-old grandson. He brings the grandson one trip on the train, sitting in the front of the train, and he's just bored and upset and oppressed to be doing one more time on this train. And the son is completely excited. This is the most exciting and most wonderful thing that's ever happened. This boundless world is opened up to this child, and full of excitement and joy. What's the difference between those two impressions? The world of the train is exactly the same, isn't it, in some ways? There are differences, but the differences belong to the world of constructions. And it's said that the suffering that Buddhism is primarily concerned with is a suffering that comes from our constructions, the way we construct the world, the way we relate to the world. The way we relate to the world has to do with the way we construct the world, the way we construct our relationship to the world. This world of constructions and abstractions. So, central to this world of constructions, of relationships, is attachment. at least from the point of view of suffering. So the second noble truth is that the cause of suffering is attachment. And maybe attachment maybe is not the best word. The literal word is tanha, and that means thirst. And maybe better than attachment is, say, craving or clinging. Because attachment, many people like attachment, you know, has good connotations for some people. But clinging or craving or anxious desire. And it should be said that the problem is not the object of clinging, but it's the clinging itself is the problem. And that in religious world is often confused, because these two seem so inseparable at times. Often religious people will reject the object of clinging without taking responsibility for the clinging itself. So therefore, you know, sex is bad, money is bad, you know, relationships are bad, all these things are bad. What is bad is the clinging that's part of it. It's bad in the sense that it causes suffering. So we don't have to turn away from anything. We don't have to renounce the world necessarily. But we need to find a different kind of relationship that is not based on clinging or craving. Something that can allow for the change and the flux, for the impermanence and the uncertainty. Sometimes in books on Buddhism, they translate the word tanha as desire. And that gets into more trouble than using the word attachment, because there are also wholesome desires, appropriate desires. And then suddenly you're in this complicated discussion about which, you know, is Buddhism so pessimistic it rejects all desires? So it's not rejecting desire, it's really this much stronger thing, this anxious desire or clinging and craving. However, kind of the footnote to this is that desire can also easily slip into thirst, into clinging, into craving. The way that I just, so suffering is a central issue in Buddhist practice. But in focusing on suffering, the suffering that we focus on in Buddhist practice is what I call relational suffering. It's the kind of suffering that occurs to us through the kind of relationship we form with reality, we form with our life. It's not unavoidable suffering we're trying to avoid. It's the relational suffering we're trying to avoid. But the kind of suffering that comes from the way in which we relate. If we relate with aversion, there's suffering. Just aversion itself is suffering. And the tendency is aversion itself, the resistance and the pushing away, compounds the suffering, compounds the pain. There's also suffering in excessive attachment or holding on. And that also can be painful. Is it necessary to hold on? Can we have enough trust in our life that we don't have to hold on for security for anything? Because to hold on is painful. I like to tell the story of my first long retreat in Thailand. I had a tremendous amount of physical pain in my legs. And I would go to my meditation teacher and say, "Oh, my legs hurt." And he would give me good advice, what to do, how to be mindful of it. And I would go back and do it. And I'd come back the next day and say, "They hurt more." And he'd say something else. And this is all happening through a translator in Thailand. And after about the fourth day of this, the American monk who was translating for me whispered, as we were leaving the abbot's house, he leaned over to me and said, "You're really attached to your pain, aren't you?" And that caught my attention, because I didn't think you could be attached to pain, and I would want to get rid of it. But it was such an odd statement that I went back to my meditation place and reflected on it and discovered that the aversion I had to the pain was a kind of attachment. And when I could see that, when I was able to see and recognize the aversion clearly, then I could see to which degree that very pushing it away was actually causing the pain to be worse. Just physically, it was obvious, not just mentally, but physically. I could feel all this contraction around the pain, increasing the pain. And when I could start seeing the way in which my relationship to the pain increased the pain, I was able to let go of my attachment and my aversion, and the physical pain got a lot less. It basically became manageable. It said that the desire for tranquility is the last attempt to impose structure on our life, to impose security on our life. And meditators, people who are serious meditators, it's often the last attempt to hold on, is attachment to tranquility. And there's a quote from Patanjali: attachment is a state of ignorance based on a memory of pleasure. So then there's a third noble truth, which is called the end of suffering, sometimes called freedom. And the point here is that freedom or cessation of suffering is a real possibility. And this is the joyful news. If the suffering was the kind of unfortunate news, this is supposed to be the fortunate news, the good news. And one definition of freedom or nibbana that's given in the early Buddhist texts is it involves the calming of the constructions, calming of all these kind of elaborations and thoughts and abstractions that the mind makes. And it's very significant, I think, it says calming. It doesn't say stopping them or ending them or seizing them and having clearly a blank mind. But it means calming them enough so that they don't kind of, either so they don't create suffering, to create attachment, or so that you could see clearly what's happening so that you don't get caught by anything. To calm the constructions, to release the constraints and constrictions in the heart. So the way out of the trap of suffering is said to be presence, to practice presence or awareness or insight, to see clearly, to understand clearly what is going on. Jack Kornfield tells a story of when he was practicing with Ajahn Chah in Thailand, his teacher Ajahn Chah, that Ajahn Chah would sometimes walk around the monastery and ask his various monks, "Are you suffering today?" And if the monk said no, then he'd say, "Oh, okay, good." He'd go on. And if the monk said, "Yes, I'm suffering today," he'd look, he'd kind of smile at them and say, "Oh, so you're attached today." So there's a possibility of ending the cycles of suffering. The Buddha, partly because he was anti-metaphysical, tended not to describe what this end of suffering felt like and how it was experienced. As soon as you kind of describe it too much, then it becomes kind of a real thing that you kind of hold on to. Is presence a real thing? Where's presence? Where do you find presence? So, you know, but presence maybe is the way out, or the way in, or something. But sometimes, anyway, sometimes it is called, this state of freedom or awakening is called, it's described as being peaceful, happy, tranquil, cool. Cool is often a common description. It's real cool. So then I have written down here, true awareness is a strength and maturity that sees life without condemnation or selfishness or attachment. So then finally there's a fourth noble truth. And this is that...
Can I say something?
Yeah.
One of my complaints about religions is that they seem to know a great deal more about suffering than they do about freedom. Yeah, I noticed that we spent about half an hour on freedom and 5 minutes, or half an hour on suffering and 5 minutes on freedom. It's kind of proportion bothers me.
You heard the story I told last week of showing up at a sitting group and said, announcing the beginning, I was going to talk about enlightenment. Before I do, does anybody have any questions? And then we spent the whole next 45 minutes talking about anger. Maybe that's right, what you're saying. It's a good point to be made. Kind of partly in defense of Buddhism, at least. I don't feel like I have to be defensive, but the defense is that, as what I just said, is that it's very easy to become attached to an ideal if you describe what freedom is. And so we don't describe it very much. So rather we focus on those keeps us from being free, so that those constraints aren't there anymore. And then we find ourselves in this place which we prefer not to describe. So, and that's basically how mindfulness practice works anyway. Mindfulness practice itself, 95% of the time, what we're attending to is what keeps us from being free. So maybe the teaching should reflect those percentages. Keep the practice somehow realistic, or the teaching realistic. But freedom is a real possibility. And there's lots to be said about it. Maybe I'll say two things. One thing is that there's two kinds of freedom. There's what's called, in a sense, momentary freedom, a momentary awakening. And then there's kind of a larger, more pervasive, penetrating form of freedom or peace. The momentary freedom is just simply what comes from mindfulness practice. The moment of mindfulness is a moment of awakening. It's a really, and this is hard to believe, maybe, because you're mindful of difficult things. But to have an awareness that sees things as they are, without condemnation, without clinging, without pushing away, without rejection, without holding on, is that is a kind of freedom. That's a kind of awakening, which is very satisfying. And I stress this over and over again, that the goal and the means are the same in mindfulness practice. That the means, the goal is to be mindful, and the means to be mindful is to be mindful. So it's really great to do something, you do it, and you've done it. And instead, sometimes this is called the small awakening. And it's very similar to big awakenings. A Buddha stubs his toe or her toe, and if he or she is aware of that in a mindful way, that state of that Buddha mind is the same as our Buddha mind if we're aware of it in a very clear, complete, mindful way without judgment or evaluation or rejection. So that's one kind. And then there's, if you do that thoroughly, however, if you're completely thorough about that kind of mindfulness, and do it continually and very thoroughly, it begins to penetrate deeply into our marrow, in a sense, the marrow of our mind, in a sense. And there's a possibility for a transformation of our relationship to the world, a radical transformation of the mind. And there's a different kind of experience almost, which is not an experience, which happens when you're completely thorough about this. If you talk too much about these things, especially as Westerners, we tend to strive after it too much. And it doesn't make any sense to strive after it. You can't strive after the ultimate freedom, because the gate to ultimate freedom is to the momentary freedom. And in the momentary freedom, you can't have any striving. So you're stuck. Excuse me. Just one footnote here. See, I was about to describe the path to becoming free, and I was interrupted.
We're not done with suffering yet, okay? We're too attached. I'm too attached to it. But in the state of freedom, is it that there is no suffering, or is it that the awareness of all suffering, which is, it doesn't mean anything anymore?
This answer isn't straightforward, but I'll give what's an inadequate answer, which is pretty close, because of the shortness of time. And that is that the suffering that ends is relational suffering. And so, Buddha isn't free of all suffering. There's other forms of suffering besides relational suffering, from the relationship you form with life. So Buddha isn't free of all pain.
He stubs his toe and hurts.
But there's no there's this wonderful analogy that Buddha gives of if a man is struck by an arrow, that's pretty painful. We agree with that. However, if he's then struck by a second arrow, that's maybe worse. That's also pretty painful. It's more painful. What happens is there is unavoidable pain that we experience. And most of us add a second arrow to that pain by contracting around it, by rejecting it, by feeling self-pity and all the kind of things we do. So for the unavoidable forms of suffering, we're learning to live in the midst of that with equanimity and peace and not add another arrow to it. However, there's also the relational suffering, and that you can do completely away with. At least that's, I haven't done that myself, so I shouldn't say. But this is what the Buddhist tradition claims. And it's my faith that it's true, whatever my faith is worthwhile, whatever as good it is. So then there's a fourth truth, and that's the path that leads from suffering. And it's usually described as the Eightfold Noble Path. And it's eight different levels or aspects or steps or areas which you need to take care of in order to kind of begin finding some freedom from suffering. And I won't go through these different eight tonight, but I just list them. They have to do with our view, waking up to the kind of views we have about the world, and having a right view or appropriate view of the world. It has to do with our attitude, it has to do with our speech, it has to do with our livelihood, it has to do with the kind of effort that we use, that we engage in our spiritual life. It has to do with mindfulness, it has to do with concentration. And somehow attending to all these different areas of our life is how we support and express the practice, express our awakening. That the practice of awakening doesn't exist separate from our actions, our speech, our livelihood, our attitudes, our views, and all these things. That unless we attend to these things and somehow try to clean them up, you don't have the support, the stable support, for doing spiritual practice. It's very hard, as they say, to meditate after robbing a bank. Or as I said to someone earlier here, someone came on retreat and asked a lawyer and said, I'm expected to lie as a lawyer. How can I lie and still be a Buddhist? You can't, is the answer. You can't be really mindful. You can't cultivate deep mindfulness and lie at the same time. So cleaning up our life to some degree ethically is a very important foundation in order to do meditation practice. So the fourth noble truth has to do with how we live our lives. And it's the recognition that awakening is not automatic. It needs, in some sense, some kind of behavioral change. And we often don't stress that. We often stress that mindfulness is enough. In a sense, mindfulness is enough. You don't have to worry about behavioral changes, because if your mindfulness becomes stronger, you realize that you probably need to make some changes. And it becomes, then you become your own authority for those changes. But you should be aware that maybe that's what it requires. If you're lying in your business, maybe you need to change work or stop lying. So it said there's no freedom without attention to our attitudes, our speech, our actions, our livelihood. It's also said that all four of these truths, you can understand them conceptually, but these four noble truths are said to be very difficult to understand in their deep aspect, deeper aspects of them. And it's said that they become an insight rather than an understanding, more of an intuitive insight. At the level which they become an insight, All four truths are realized simultaneously. You see a situation. What? All four truths are realized simultaneously. You see a situation, and you understand how all four aspects of these truths are present in that situation. You see, if you're miserable, if you're having some suffering, you see that you see clearly the suffering. At the same time, you see what the cause is. You see, for example, maybe your attachment. You see that there's a possibility of being free of the suffering. So you see that as part of the insight into it. And then you see what you need to do to some degree in order to become free of that suffering. So all those four are possible at the same moment. And this is when seeing all those four together is when these four noble truths switch from becoming an intellectual understanding to becoming an intuitive understanding. And then in my own formulation of the Four Noble Truths, in the end, the Four Noble Truths are a teaching to help us, teaching of acceptance, of trust, and also of empowerment. That what we're coming to in awakening is a very pervasive, all-pervasive form of trust or acceptance. I like the word trust. So that we can live in this world with trust and acceptance, and with enough empowerment that we can act fully in the world at the same time. So these Four Noble Truths are the jewel, considered to be one of the jewels of Buddhism, and I imagine that if you listen to the Buddha give a talk on the Four Noble Truths, you would shiver in hearing them, in understanding, and implications of them. But anyway, you probably haven't shivered tonight. So, I wish you all well. Good night.